Greetings and welcome on board our WKOK Sunrise program. I'm Mark Lawrence. Today we're going to find out about what life was like during the 1700s, particularly around December 25th, but we're kind of get a glimpse of how our area was evolving then and really just get a sense on what life was like. I'm so glad to say we have really an actual expert here. John Moore is back. He's an author, a storyteller, a real historian, and he's got a dozen history books and still writing columns and all kinds of things and doing research. And he's got two new books out that I got a chance to look at. The two new books are The Outposts, and Border War. Now, we already talked a little bit about those earlier this month, so just go back to WKOK.com and look for John Moore, and you'll see those articles. Very interesting interviews about what was happening on the frontier in Pennsylvania, so it was really, it's pretty timely and pretty local, and you find out about, well, not forgotten, but how Brandywine took all the oxygen out of the room, as they say.
Sure. Well, good morning, Mark, and Merry Christmas. A little bit early.
Yeah, you too. Thank you very much. I always appreciate your words and what you bring to our show. Let's start at 1768. You tell me that was when land that was Iroquois occupied was ceded to settlers and became the Pennsylvania, Virginia,
New York frontier.
New York frontier. So now we're on the frontier in this part of our area, and people are coming up here to live.
Right. Until 1768, most of the Susquehanna Valley, the upper Susquehanna Valley, was Iroquois territory. The Iroquois, of course, were the Iroquois Federation, the Six Nations, out of western New York. The Lens Session of 1768 really opened the Pennsylvania frontier to settlement. And not surprisingly, people started pouring in. They came up on horseback. They walked. They pulled hand carts, pushed hand carts. They came in wagons. Men came up with their wives and children and hired people, indentured servants, and slave people. And they were able to come up and find land and buy it dirt cheap, literally. And by 1772, Northumberland and Sunbury had enough people to become towns. And then farther up the West Branch, people went up and settled as far up as Lock Haven, and up the North Branch as far up as Nescopeck and beyond. Farther up the Wyoming Valley, there were settlers who had poured in from Connecticut. And so the Pennsylvanians really didn't go up very far because there was really a lot of hard feelings between the Connecticut people and the settlers from Pennsylvania. And by 1775, 1776, the Native Americans who had lived in our region for thousands of years were pretty much pushed north and west. And you had to go well beyond Lock Haven before you encountered isolated families of Delaware Indians or Shawnee Indians or possibly Iroquois Indians. But largely they were gone. They were pushed way up the West Branch and way up, far up the North Branch, almost into New York State. And we really didn't see a lot of Native people. A missionary in 1775 came through Sunbury, Northumberland, and he went all the way up to Jersey Shore and Lock Haven. And beyond Lock Haven, he encountered families of Indians. And he was terrified, but they were very peaceful. And when they learned he was preaching, they came and attended some of his services. So they were friendly toward the Christians. And, you know, it was very friendly. The Revolutionary War, started in Massachusetts in 1775, very slowly spread down the East Coast into 1776. And in December 1776, we had Washington make a sneak attack on Trenton. He crossed the Delaware River with 2,000 men and caught the Hessians sleeping. certainly the Hessian commander Rahl was sleeping, and Washington soldiers very quickly defeated the Hessians, took 600 or 700 Hessians prisoners, and then went back into northern New Jersey for the rest of the winter. People here, militias organizations here, were sending soldiers down to reinforce Washington in December 1776. A militia company left Sunbury in late December, heading down toward the Delaware to meet. By the time they got to the Delaware, Washington moved up, and they had to switch gears and move over into New Jersey to find his army, which they did.
Well, let me stop you there. Sure. This is a perfect stepping off point. So now you have folks living in the Sunbury and Northumberland area and in all the rural areas, farmers living in all the, well, everything's right. Pretty much rural at that point. But, okay, so winters were colder then. We know that from climatologists. They tell us winters were about 20 degrees colder and much snowier.
Right.
And there isn't enough firewood. There's not enough food. You have to hunt for what you need. But still, folks in this area are saying, oh my gosh, we've got it made. This is perfect.
Well, the people who were coming up, the white people who were coming up into the region to settle, were often the younger children in a family. Most Pennsylvanians at this point were living on farms, and they had purchased the farms early on, and maybe they were third and fourth generation farms by 1778. And when a man had a family, he passed his farm on to his oldest son. And it was the third and fourth and fifth sons who were leaving Philadelphia and Lancaster and Reading and Bethlehem and coming up into the frontier, because they were not getting much in the way of an inheritance. And so their father and brothers gave them warm wishes and may have helped underwrite their expeditions.
And so along comes December of 1777.
Sure.
Describe Christmas.
Describe Christmas. Christmas would be primarily a religious ceremony. And it would be held quite possibly on New Year's Eve late or Christmas Day. The Moravians had a hymn, not Jerusalem, but lowly Bethlehem. And that was the hymn which they sang pretty much a cappella or with very elementary instruments in their log cabin in what is now the city of Bethlehem. The city of Bethlehem took its name from that hymn. There might be a present or two, not much. There might be a nice dinner. Depends on what was in the family larder, whether the father had gone out and been able to shoot a turkey, or whether he and his sons had been able to bag a buck or a doe, or maybe a bear. And it would be a very quiet time. There would be some praying, some perhaps a little sermon. No Christmas tree. Probably no gifts yet. Christmas trees come in with the Hessians and with the Germans in 1777. A British general, Burgoyne, lost the Battle of Saratoga, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Hessian and German soldiers who were captured, including a German general and his wife, and she was known as the Baronessa, and the Baroness. And I'm not going to murder her name by mispronouncing it, but she was with her husband, and she and her husband spent 4 years as prisoners. They were prisoners in Massachusetts, and then in Virginia, and then Maryland, and quite possibly down around Lancaster and Reading before they were returned at the year's end. And they were in the province of Quebec in 1781, and to celebrate their return to freedom, getting out of a prisoner of war camp, they had a big gala, and the Baroness went out and got a fir tree and decked it out with ornaments and candles and had a Christmas tree. And that's the first documented instance that I can find of anybody having an actual Christmas tree in North America.
Well, 100 years later, you start to look in Sunbury newspapers and you see here words about Christmas trees.
I found some interesting things. There were no ads. I went through 3 or 4 issues of the Evening Item for December 1896. And I went through papers in the second half of the month.
And that's a Sunbury paper.
That's the Sunbury paper, and it's the successor is the Daily Item of today. And I found a few advertisements for, quote, tree ornaments, but no ads and no articles about Christmas trees. And that makes me think that either people are not having Christmas trees or there is still enough woodland in the region that they can go out and find their own Christmas tree and bring it home without paying anybody for it, or maybe paying the landowner 50 cents or a dollar. And I found some other things there, too. One of the things was that December of 1896 had been very warm, and people were very grumpy. They wanted to have a white Christmas. And as Christmas time came, as we're up into a week before Christmas, the land is green and brown, no snow anywhere, and it's very warm. And the old people were getting very long faces, and they were saying, well, a green Christmas makes a fat graveyard. And I think that what they're talking about is that you have disease coming associated with the warm winter weather. And then you had no vaccines, you had no antibiotics, and you had all sorts of things from whooping cough to diphtheria to influenza. And nobody had much in the way of defenses. And so when it was warm in late December, in January, people became ill and died. And so, and the article said, and I'll just read it verbatim, the adage, a green Christmas makes a fat graveyard, has been quoted by long-faced persons hundreds of times within the past month, and all wished for snow. The snow is here, and all should now be happy.
Yeah, so the snow and the freezing would kill bacteria and bugs that were carrying bacteria. To this day, hunters like a frigid, cold winter that lasts 3 or 4 weeks of below freezing temperature to kill ticks that are out in the woods. We still talk about
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
So we're still doing the same thing.
And I think in Irving Berlin's song, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas like the ones I used to know, that what we think of it as the scenery, the very picturesque, beautiful village scene and country scene. And I think what the old people thought about, my grandparents, for instance, would have thought, okay, if it's really white and really cold, there'll be less illness, and more of us will get by, live to see spring. And that's something that never occurred to me before. I also was intrigued to see that Christmas shopping was quite popular. The article said that the stores have all been doing a brisk Christmas present business. And by the time this article is read, everybody will be ready for the great gift-giving and receiving day. Candy is cheap, and by tomorrow night, that's Christmas night, not Christmas Eve, every child in town will have a package.
Well, okay, so now in 1777, it's pretty austere times and certainly not much abundance, but people are glad they got their inexpensive land and they have a homestead, and most of the year's not that cold, you say, so, you know, most of the year is livable, so that happens.
Sure.
So 120-some years later, we have 1896, and we have celebrations and packages and ornaments, and so this is catching on. When did we start to get opulent? When did we kind of go full of lights and excessive gifts, and it's a commercialization opportunity?
I'm thinking that's going to be in the 1920s and not so much the 1930s. I'm 80. When I was 10, I got some electric railroad, model railroads for Christmas. But my trains had been made in the 1920s. They were museum pieces when I got them.
Okay.
And so there was a whole lot of things going on. Electricity had become cheap and plentiful. And with the advent of electricity, you could have electric-powered toys like railroad trains, and you could have electric lights. I remember we visited our daughter recently, and in the top of her tree is an ornament, an angel that had been on the top of my parents' tree in the 1930s. Now, the angel has new wings, and the angel has a new gown, but she has the same hairstyle as a 1920s flapper would have had. So it's an ornament that goes back a full century. That's been a renovated ornament, if you will.
Okay, and still a certain element of austerity is associated with this. We're headed towards the Depression, at which time all of this
exactly
is
going to
be, become
sure.
pretty muted.
But after World War II, we got into the opulence.
Okay, so yeah.
And I remember when electric lights started going on in front of houses in the early 50s, and everybody tried to keep up with the Joneses, as it were. If Mr. Brown had lots of electric lights in 1953, his next-door neighbor, Mr. Smith, had more lights than he did the next year, 1954. So it escalated, there were competitions to see who could, just like we have competitions today for picturesque things. So,
and most homes do some decorating, right, today?
Some must do, yes.
Yeah, most do something, okay.
Something, yes.
Let's step back into the 1700s real quickly. In your book, Tories, Terror, and Tea, you talk about one Christmas time story, not specifically related to the celebration of Christmas, but you talk about one story that happened back then. Tell us about that.
Sure. In December 1773, mid-December, we had the Boston Tea Party, and everybody knows about the Boston Tea Party. The East India Company had lots of tea in its warehouses in London, and the East India Company decided to send the tea to the American colonies, and once the tea was unloaded, it would be taxed right at the wharf, and the colonists objected. They were being taxed without representation. As it happened, it's a well-kept secret, perhaps, but the East India Company also decided to send a ship to Philadelphia, which was the biggest of the English colonial cities in North America. The ship had a captain named Ayres. The name of the ship was the Polly. The Polly had a cargo capacity of about 250 tons, and the East India Company loaded 600 chests of tea aboard the Polly and send it to the Delaware River. News reached Philadelphia months ahead, and there was an infuriated uproar. And the people of Philadelphia quickly organized a committee for tarring and feathering. They were going to get a hold of that ship captain, and if he tried to unload his tea, they were going to tar and feather him. In order to get from the Atlantic Ocean up the Delaware, a sea captain needed to have a river pilot who knew where all the sandbars and the shoals were and the deep water channels were. These were called river pilots. And the Committee for Tarring and Feathering announced that any river pilot who brings the tea ship Polly upriver is going to get tarred and feathered. And so when the Polly finally shows up off the coast of Delaware and New Jersey, in December of 1773, no river pilot will take it upriver. So it sits out there. And Captain Ayres is a shrewd man, very realistic. He sees another ship going up with a river pilot aboard. And so he just simply follows that ship. Every place that ship goes, the Polly goes. And so pretty soon, an express rider reaches Philadelphia with news that the Polly is now off Wilmington. And the committee and the officials of this committee were Thomas Tarbucket, Peter Pitch, Benjamin Brush, clearly fictitious. And so they sent...
And Frank Feather. Why not?
Sure. They sent an express rider down to meet the ship. But by the time the committee got there, the Polly had already come farther up. And so other citizens intercepted the ship about 4 or 5 miles below Philadelphia. And they called the captain who came ashore to see what the matter was. And they quickly convinced the captain to leave his ship in the river and come with them to Philadelphia for a meeting at the State House, which is now known as Independence Hall. But when Captain Ayers arrived with the committee, he found there were so many people to meet him and greet him that they couldn't meet inside the State House. Instead, they met in the square across. And it's open air, and it's right after Christmas. The committee explained to Captain Ayers if he unloaded the ship, he would get tarred and feathered.
But that they're really tarring and really feathering.
Really tarring and really feathering. Oh, now, sometimes they just stripped him down to his underwear to tar and feather somebody. And sometimes they would strip him naked and then tar him. And he was tarred with tar from pine trees.
And, of course, there's no gasoline to get oil or tar off of anything now. So
this was a pitch from a pitch pine tree.
Wouldn't it make you sick?
It would. I wouldn't want to be tarred and feathered. The captain readily agreed that the Polly would not attempt to land.
Sound advice.
No.
Or sound decision.
He was a realistic thinker. And he was given 48 hours to go through the city and buy the supplies he needed to get aboard this so that he and his crew could sail the Polly back to London. And it was December 28th, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Captain Ayers went down to the Arch Street Wharf in Philadelphia. And he had been in town 48 hours, and he was attended to the wharf by a huge crowd of people, and they wished him a good voyage.
And let's see, one other Christmas story. Of course, George Washington uses Christmas as the opportunity to cross the Delaware and to get to New Jersey. So tell us about that.
Okay. Well, by the time the Americans got to the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware, their numbers were few. Many had deserted. Some had died. Morale was low. They were in the snow, and they were camped in the snow. And it was a really dismal time. A lot of them did not have heavy coats. Many, their shoes had disintegrated on the march from Long Island. And it was just a pretty terrible time. Morale was very low. The Army's enlistments were about to expire the 1st of January. And Washington saw the opportunity to cross over the Delaware and make a quick sneak attack on Trenton and catch many of the Hessians there, literally sleeping. And he did. And it became a great victory at a time when the Americans desperately needed a minor miracle or a major military miracle. One of the things that happened was that a few miles south of Trenton had been a large Hessian force under Colonel Donop, D-O-N-O-P, Donop. Some days prior to Christmas, Donop took his division down to Mount Holly, about 20 miles southeast of Trenton, and there was some rebel activity down there, so he had a sound military reason for going down there. But once he got there, he found a very nice place in the town to stay, and to his delight, he found a very friendly widow of a physician, a young Mary widow, and he spent a lot of time with her. And instead of returning with his soldiers to Bordentown, he remained at Mount Holly. And he was still there in Mount Holly when Washington whooped the other Hessians in Trenton. And Donald was so concerned because Washington was now in a position to cut Donop's soldiers off. Donop made a hurried retreat up toward Princeton to get out of the way of any advance Washington might have made. The question is, who was the Merry Widow who entertained him? And what's interesting is that one of his officers wrote about the escapade with the Merry Widow. There was no Mary, widow of a physician in Mount Holly, who had no physician had died within recent years, to leave a young widow. And there's speculation that she may have been a spy for Washington. Now, there's nothing to prove that she was, nothing to prove that she wasn't. But it's just one of those interesting stories that two centuries later just sort of works its way up to the top.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, what else would tie him down for a short time? I mean, other than good company, you know, from a woman that is in the country. Hmm. Well, thank you so much for everything. Your books, the new one, Outposts and Border War, are available online at sunburypress.com or amazon.com. Tories, Terror and Tea, Scorched Earth, General Sullivan and the Senecas, 1780, Year of Revenge, Murder at Kilbuck Island, and Against the Ice, the Story of December 1776, are all out there and available at those locations, and the authors here with us today. And for that, we've been enriched. John Moore, Northumberland, author, historian, storyteller, and writer. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Mark. Merry Christmas.